Okay, welcome back, everyone. Last time we discussed the basics of Sapphiros, and we started discussing how to go about purchasing your stam, how to choose the dealer, and what specifications to ask for, and how to if he tells you stuff, how to know what he's talking about in terms of chumras or hidurim, what's worthwhile, what's not worthwhile. So we're going to continue that now and hopefully get to a little bit about maintaining stam also, although if we don't get to that today, we can always start next time. So in terms of when you go to choose your tefillin parshias, first of all, one thing you want to pay attention to is how nice the writing is. It's a little bit hard to judge unless you're an expert and familiar with, and don't have to be an expert, but at least somewhat familiar with many different types of writing and seen different parshios. But you could tell a little bit in terms of if it looks consistent, if the lines look straight and sharp, if the vavin are clearly much longer than the yuds, for example. So that's going to, if you want nice parshios, so that's going to raise the price, obviously. It's, in theory, there could be parshios that would be halachically the same, but a less nice writing, and it would cost you less for the same halachic quality, but that there is an inyan of ze keli v'anvei, who we want to get as nice as possible. Certainly, if you're of comfortable financial means and you spend money on other things, so you should certainly spend money to get nice tefillin also.
How do you know that the tefillin is already buy it, it's made for you? So how do you know about the parshas?
Not necessarily. Yeah. If sometimes people go to pick different things, you go to pick the parshas separately, you pick the batim separately, you pick the ritzua separately. If you buy, yeah, it should, and if you know what you're doing, certainly, or you've attended my series of lectures, you should you should have your demands. You should insist on seeing the parshas and seeing a computer check sheet of the parshas. One other thing to choose besides the style of writing, which we discussed last time, is the. You see how there's a break in between each of the four paragraphs of the tefillin. So here, in the end of the first paragraph, there's like some empty space, then they start the next one. So there's a machlokas regarding the last parsha of the tefillin, Vayayim Shamoa, whether between the Rambam and the Rush, how it's supposed to be written. The minag was basically like the Rambam, the Shulchan Aruch Paskin's like the Rambam, and the way the Rambam says to do it is to leave a lot of space at the beginning of Vayayim Shamoa, to leave like the same amount of space as you see at the end of these two parshias. So he says to leave the same amount of space at the beginning of Vayayim Shamoa. However, according to the Rosh, who has a different understanding of how the parsha break should be, that would not be good. So the Taz came up with an Eitza, an idea that he claims would solve the problem, and you would actually be Yotzi both the Rambam and the Rush. So these tefillin, if you look at them, I'll pass this around, actually someone just brought this in to me. These tefillin were written like the Taz. The Taz is Eitza to be Yotzi both the Rambam and the Rush, and the way he says that is you leave a little bit of space at the end of Shema, and a little bit of space at the beginning of the Hayayim Shamoa. So if you just want to look at that as it's passed around, you could see what the Taz looks like. The most Ashkenazim go like the Taz. Rav Yoshev was very, very strong in favor of the Taz. However, there is a whole gamut of poskim that you should know about that hold that the Taz does not work. That this idea that he came up with to try to be Yotze both ends up not being good, certainly according to the Rambam. So there are poskim Rav Scheinberg, all Sephardi poskim, to the best of my knowledge, who hold that you should do like the Rambam. And this is the minhag also of many Ashkenazim also. The Chofetz Chaim, I'm friends with a great-great-grandson of the Chofetz Chaim. He told me they have a family Mesorah that the Chofetz Chaim did like the Rambam straight without the Eitz of the Taz. Rav Scheinberg also did just like the Rambam. There are many poskim who hold that you should do just straight Rambam even if you're Ashkenazi. But if you're Sephardi, you should certainly do straight Rambam. In terms of the Batim, now we leave the area of Parshias a little bit. There is a difference between what's called private Batim and factory Batim. So Batim that are made in the factory are just basically, like I said, or like it sounds, mass-produced. That it's an assembly line, you know, when they eat each stage of the process of making the bias, there is, it goes along an assembly line. So that's different from people who are called private batim makers, who basically do every stage of the process themselves, and they personally, this one batim expert, makes, is under his watchful eye the entire process of making the batim. So if you get from a good factory, there's certainly, they're going to be much cheaper. There is no halachic reason usually to get specifically the private batim, but it's, you know, it's like the equivalent of anything that's mass-produced versus versus handmade, everything handmade. Because you just, in general, just be a higher level of watchfulness in terms of the quality. If you have the money, you know, be my guest, buy private batim. But that's something you have to discuss with a dealer, different kinds, different options, different prices, etc. There's also, as you can see in the side of the batim shel rosh, there's the shape of a shin, which everybody, I'm sure, sees on their own tefillin. So there are also a lot of complex halachos about how this shin has to be formed, because it can't be formed just with a press. It has to be formed by writing the shin, which is very difficult. They use implements to push the skin in certain directions to make the shin properly. And also, there are a lot of halachos involved. So if you get from a factory, you have to make sure it has a proper hashgacha. They know what they're doing, especially in terms of making the shin. And if you get from a private maker, you should also be an expert in the laws of making the shin. And almost every case for batim, it says something like shin mashach kulo bayad, which is just a term they throw around saying, oh, we made the shin properly. But it's really, if they just claim it and it says on the box, it doesn't necessarily mean anything. In the batim shel rosh, you can see, as you can see on your own tefillin, there are four different compartments because each of the four different parashas of tefillin goes in its own special compartment. So this is in distinction to the shel yad, where everything is on one cloth, and it all goes in one hole. Well, they're not four different holes; it's all one compartment. So, as you can see, the normal way of making the four compartments together and square and nice like this is they have a big skin that's much wider than what you see now, and they press out the four compartments, then they squish it all together so that the skin ends up being folded like this. So each compartment is on its own little fold, and this whole upper part here is comprised of folds that they then glue together and then paint over, so that's why in your tefillin you cannot see the folds. There is a new technological advancement, thanks to modern technology. It was actually invented by an engineer who lives in Tellstone, using the same technology I think they used to make cans, that's what he told me, although I'm not really sure what that means at all, where he actually manages to press the four compartments out of a single solid piece of skin without the folds. As you can see here, these are just pressure marks. They're not actually folds, so this makes for a stronger bias because it's not many pieces glued together, it's just one flat, solid piece of skin. There are poskim who say that this is a hitter because you don't have to, it's all one solid piece by itself. You don't have to rely on the fact that they glue it together. It's a shiloh whether glue actually makes things to be considered like one piece or not. Also, these have holes in it, so it's like the bias has holes in it. Rav Yoshev reportedly held it was not a hitter. Can't ask him anymore, so we don't know. But in any case, these used to be the flat ones used to be much, much, much more expensive because there used to be only a couple private makers who made the what's called fold-free or bleak matim. Batim, a hider, enhancement of the mitzvah. So now they're starting to be mass produced in the factory style. Also, so they become much cheaper, but still pretty expensive. The private ones cost almost $2,000 just for the batim without the parashas, and the factory ones cost maybe somewhere between 800 and 1,000. I'm not exactly sure. So I'll pass around these two together so you can compare.
One is
when a sheet, when a description sheet says mehor echad from one piece of leather.
Oh, that's an excellent question. Can I have it back a second? That doesn't mean that. That doesn't mean the flat, solid bias. That's a very new thing. Mehor echad means that the batim, where the parshis actually go, as well as this part that folds together, mm-hmm. to close it, called the titura, are made of one piece of skin. In Europe, they used to make tefillin out of a couple pieces of skin in sort of an origami style because it's much cheaper.
When you said the folds that exist there, are those folds are still from the same piece of skin?
Yes, this is or echad. Mm-hmm. This is definitely or echad. But that's all that or echad means. I didn't even write it. That's an excellent question. I forgot to write it down. I have to remember later. There's also a halacha that the four compartments of the shel rosh have to be separate. They can't be totally glued together. Many poskim, it's very difficult to make them to be completely separate without glue and without them sort of coming apart like a flower. They'll eventually, they won't stay nice and square and together if you don't glue them together. So most people are makel to put a little bit of glue at the bottom in the middle, but the sides should still be visible and clear that it's four separate compartments. Many people are machmir that they should be no glue whatsoever between the batim. But again, those batim are going to be more expensive because it takes greater skill to be able to make batim without any glue whatsoever in between the four compartments and still stay nice and square. So those are going to run a little bit. Those are going to run a little bit extra. But you have to make sure that it's actually really separate, which is called prudos, separate compartments. A lot of batim makers just claim prudos when they don't really mean that it's actually completely, the four compartments are completely separate without any glue in between. I actually, for people, it's a little bit risky because you could damage the batim, but for people who really, really want specifically prudos, I actually take a very, very thin, dull knife, very, very thin, dull knife, and run it in between the batim before I give it to the customer. But it's a risk because if it's not really as well made as they say it is, then you could damage the batim. But that's the only way to really, really tell if they're actually prudos or not.
Maybe you should try using a dental floss instead.
Yeah, it won't go.
Won't go?
It won't go. Yeah, I've tried. Believe me. Believe me. Actually, two of the big proponents of the no glue at all shita were the Vilna Gaon and the Shagas Aryeh. So the Shagas Aryeh was actually known to ask people, and he would be in shul, and people had glue in their shel rosh so that the four compartments were not completely separate. He used to go over to them and say, "Why are you wearing your shel yad on your head?"
That's harsh.
Yeah. It's a little harsh, but in any case, according to the strict halacha, you are okay if, as long as the four compartments are separate somewhat. As long as you could tell, at least on the top and the sides, that they are separate compartments. There was actually a problem with when they painted the batim, they sometimes tried to make lines to look like the batim were separate, but they weren't actually, the lines that they made on the paint didn't correspond to the lines inside, to the actual separation between the batim. So this was a little bit of a scandal. So a lot of people went to their local sofer and had him do my knife trick, but just on the top, just to make sure that the charitzim, the spaces between the four compartments, were in the accurate places. There's another hiddur that a lot of people want, which is that when they sew up the tefillin, they pass the thread in between each compartment, because the gid rather, not the thread, because that really proves that the batim are completely separate, because you have this string running in between each one, and that some Rishonim say, one Rishon actually, the Mordechai, I think, says it's halacha l'moshe mi-Sinai to do that, but that's not the normal practice. But if you look around, it's becoming more popular nowadays. Oh, yeah? I mean, more popular now is if you look around in shul, you see people with a shel rosh, you could see on the bottom, in between the compartments, they have the sewing thread, the gidim, running through the compartments. There is a hitter also that a lot of people throw around, which is not, according to the vast majority of post-game, is not a hitter at all, which is, I need my mic for 1 second. Not that one. Thank you. Which is, they want the entire thing to be one solid piece of leather and not have to put any filler pieces in the middle here when just to make it thicker when they sew it shut. I didn't have a good example of it. I mean, batim, unpainted, unfinished batim are slightly hard to come by. But that is, it makes it stronger maybe, but halachically speaking, it's not really worthwhile to spend extra money on. The best, if you want the best batim anyway, then they're going to be without the filler piece in the middle, which is called miksha anyway. But if the dealer offers you two batim and says one's miksha and one's not, there's really no hitter per se in having it miksha without the thing in the without the filler piece in the middle. There's a machlokes between the Chazon Ish and the Mishneh Berurah whether after you sew the tefillin up, if you're allowed to put glue in the middle of the two sides of the titurah to hold it together. The Mishneh Berurah says that since the main sewing was done by the Gidim, which is the Halacha L'Moshe Mi-Sinai, that's how it's supposed to be sewn, then if you add a little bit of glue afterwards, it doesn't make a difference halachically. However, the Chazon Ish says if the glue actually is mevatel, it nullifies the sewing of the Gidim, which is what's actually required halachically, because the batim are held together anyway with the glue. The titurah is held together anyway with the glue, so the Gidim don't actually do anything. The minug is like the Mishneh Berurah, that you're allowed to put glue. If you see in your tefillin that there's probably, you can't see the crack at all between the two halves of the titurah when they're sewn together, it's probably because it's been glued. If you can see the crack, either there's very little glue, which is probably okay, or it's really been glued together after the sewing. I personally don't see any problem with being machmir like the Chazon Ish. It's not going to damage the tefillin. That's how they did it for thousands of years. They just sewed it up without any glue. The batim machers won't want you to be machmir like the Chazon Ish because it makes their life harder because the batim might warp a little bit or they might not be able to do as good a job and it won't look quite as pretty without the glue. But if you want no glue in the titura, I think you should go for it and tell the batim machar it doesn't have to look quite as beautiful because you're interested in the halachic advantages, not purely the aesthetic ones. Unless, of course, you are only interested in aesthetics. In which case, to glue it up. There was also a scandal, which is, Baruch Hashem, it's not really an issue anymore, although there has been in the past, where when there would be holes in the skin of the bias, the batim machar would fill it up with glue instead of with skin. Or if the corners would be worn away or something, so it wouldn't be square anymore, which it has to be, they would just dab on a little bit of glue and paint over it. It was actually the batim machar, I don't know exactly who, but a lot of the briskers in Israel took from this batim machar because he was supposed to be the best and amazing, and it was actually his batim that turned out to have the glue on them. So it's not so much a problem anymore, but again, it's just something to keep in mind that it's certainly...
How would you be able to tell if that...
You can't. You have to scrape off the paint.
Scrape off the paint.
Yeah, so that's really the only way to do it. You have to get batim either with a good hechsher, or you know for sure that the batim machar is not going to do that. Or if you're not 100% sure, there's some sofrim do this. It takes extra time and energy, so it's not a very popular thing to do, but they actually buy the batim without paint, so they can inspect them before they've been painted, and then they buy them from Israel like that. Then they give it to someone to paint here in America, and privately. So it's going to be more expensive because it takes more time and energy on the part of the sofer. As far as I know, there's only one person in America who makes batim. I could be totally wrong, but there's someone in Lakewood who makes this. That's where I got this from, actually. There's someone in Lakewood who makes his own batim, but the vast majority of batim on the market are made in Israel. When you choose the size of the batim, strictly speaking, there's no limit or minimum size. So there are some shittas that there has to be a minimum of two etzbos, two thumb widths thick, wide, but you're not going to find batim really that are smaller than that. And people who want specifically really tiny batim, Either they have a different way of calculating the shear of two etzbos, or they don't really care about the shear because anyway, Maker Adin, Shulchan Aruch paskins that they don't have a shear. They don't have a requisite size. So, but there is a problem with the smaller batim that you have, the harder it is to get it to be properly formed and the quality to be good, because the skin is thick anyway, so to get it to be smaller and smaller and smaller just creates problems. But if you have a need for specifically very small tefillin, there could be, there's also a middle ground between the really small ones, which you might have seen by people who wear two at a time, who are Rashi and Benetan tefillin at the same time, there are two really tiny pairs of tefillin, like one in back of the other. So if you're interested in small tefillin for travel, or because if your bar mitzvah boy is particularly small and he can't fit the tefillin in the proper area, that on the arm usually it's the problem, then some people go with smaller batim or a smaller shalyad. But that's something, the exact place where the tefillin has to go is something we'll get to when we talk about the placement of tefillin and mezuzahs.
Somebody put on, I've seen people who put on two pairs of tefillin. After the service is over, they put on Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam.
Yeah.
Is there a cost factor difference between the two types of tefillin? Because the fact that you wear for such a short duration, the second pair.
I'll get to that in a few minutes. Well, when you get to Rabbeinu Tam tefillin.
All right, thank you.
Okay, so that's it for batim. Any questions about batim before we move on to resuos?
Did you say they wear both Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam at the same time?
There are some Kabbalists who wear Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam at the same time.
Multiple.
Yeah?
Svardim?
Mostly Svardim, yeah.
Yeah, Svardim do that.
Not to sound more ignorant than I usually am. It says in the Torah we're supposed to wear these things on our arms and head.
Yeah.
The mezuzah is about when... No, tell me Avraham or being...
The Gemara says it's Alach L'Moshe Misinai, where you put or they learn it out from the Psukim, various things. But we'll there's going to be a shir on where you put tefillin and mezuzah, so we'll go into more in detail then. Yeah. So, in terms of ritsuos, the straps, first thing you have to make sure is that they're from a kosher animal. I actually read a story recently about Rabbi Landau from Bnei Brak, who was thinking about giving a hechsher, I guess, to a ritsuos factory I think it said Western Europe, so probably France, but I'm not sure. And he went to the factory and he said, well, where do you get your hides from? They said, oh, you know, like, whatever, we from the local slaughterhouse, we get our hides delivered. So he said, well, that's okay, because they don't need to be shechted in a kosher manner, they just need to be from a kosher animal. But if you look at a hide, can you tell... Do you know how to tell the difference between the hide from a cow and a hide from a horse? So Mashgiach said, no. So, first of all, the most important thing is they have to be from a kosher animal. Secondly, there's a... they have to be lishma, they have to be imbued with the special intention of using these for tefillin, well, just like the klaf itself. So when during the tanning process, it has to be done by a Jew. Different hechsherim have different standards about when the processing has to start, that it's to be done by a Jew. Some allow the initial salting of the hides to be done by non-Jews. The Eid HaRedis, for example, in Israel, is makbid that absolutely no stage of the processing whatsoever should be done by a non-Jew. It has to be done completely by hand by a Jew. Most ritsuos on the market that you'll find nowadays, was not the case several years ago, are handmade. It's called avodas yad, which is an extra hitter because when you want to imbue the hides when you tan them with a certain level of kedusha, you want the Jew himself to be actually doing it and not just pressing a button. We just discussed last time, like with matzah for the seder, it has to be lishma. So that's why a lot of people use handmade matzah for the seder.
The batim also has to be made lishma, right?
The batim also has to be made lishma, yeah. But yeah, that's not usually a problem.
What do you think about machine, though?
As far as I heard, actually, I'm not 100% sure about this, but I think there's one central place in Israel that makes all the skins that are used for batim. So they're done to the highest standard because they want it to be able to sell to the Eid HaRedis and to other Hechsherim also. So as far as I know, there's no problems out there on the market with hides used for batim. Don't take my word for that. Make sure the bottom have a proper rupture.
The hide has to be made with lishma, but not the bias itself.
That also has to be lishma.
They do it in a machine.
I mean, it's not really by machine. It's a hand press, yeah, or a hydraulic press. It's not like you press a button and it's an electronic machine making it. There is more question about that, actually, in terms of when the final polishing of the bias is done to make it perfectly square. So some people want it to be done by a hand-powered tool. Most poskim say it's not a problem if it's the sandpaper is running on an electronic wheel, because you need to guide it with your hand anyway, so that's considered avodas yad. So I'm excellent questions. I didn't go into it because I don't think they're major problems. You're pretty good either way, and if you get batim with a very reliable hechsher, it shouldn't be an issue. Same thing with ritzuas. The best ritzuas are under the hechsher of the Yedah Haridus. You don't need it really, unless you're the rest.
The straps,
yeah. So unless the rest of your, in other words, if you have old tefillin from a long time ago and they're not such good kashrus, and you want to change the ritzuas now, so it doesn't really make sense to get a chayrus ritzuas. But if you're getting, high quality new tefillin nowadays, probably makes sense. They also have more of more control over what goes on. Some of the other hechsherim that give hechsher to ritzuas, they just sort of set up the factory, make sure everything is sort of going according to what they want, and they don't really send the mashgiach that much. It's probably fine. That's not probably nothing wrong with it. But in terms of when the tanning lishma starts and when and the level of supervision of the factories, the haridus is better when it comes to ritzuas. There was a scandal recently, you might have heard about it, about the paint. There was some ritzuas that the paint peeled off. Whether it's a halachic problem or not, most people probably didn't want the paint of the ritzuas to be peeling off. So as far as I know, that's pretty much been fixed. Okay, so there's also the issue of black-on-black ritzuas, that there's a new fad nowadays that the entire ritzua is soaked through with black dye. It's left to sit. Before it's painted with a nice shiny black paint, the skin, the hide of the animal, which is going to be cut into ritzuas, is left to soak in a vat of dye. So it permeates the skin, and the dye, it's completely black through and through. So this has two advantages. One is that there's halacha l'moshe Sinai that the ritzuas has to be black, so even if the nice shiny black paint that looks pretty and that's on the side that faces out, on the side that faces out, gets worn away, it'll still be black because underneath it's completely soaked through black. There's another, some say the Arizal said it also, but mainly the sheet of the Rambam is that the ritzuas should be the same color as the bias. So our minhag, although not all Rishonim hold it's required, our minhag nowadays, and all Rishonim say this is preferable, is to paint the bias back black. So therefore, the back of the ritzua should match the bias according to the Rambam. We don't really paskin like that. That wasn't the minhag, for hundreds of years. But if you want the practical advantage of getting the black soaked through, so you don't really have to worry about it, fine. It's not, but really, it's not the halachic advantage per se. Ritzuas do wear out. I mean, they'll wear out faster probably if you don't have the black on black. So maybe it's kedai to get that. Some people don't want their skin touching so much paint for health reasons. I don't know if it's really a problem or not. But there was a story, actually, which I'm blanking on right now. I'm blanking on it. Anyway, so the most post-game nowadays are not going with the black-on-black ritzuas. Now you have to choose when you're getting your tefillin, whether your minhagim in terms of the ksharim, how to tie the ritzuas. So let's start with the shel yad. The main difference in the ritzuas of the shel yad are whether you wrap out like this or wrap in like this. Wrapping out is the Sfardi minhag, which was taken over by the Hasidim. And the original Ashkenazi minhag is the wrapping in. So the poskim say if you don't have a minug, if you're a Baal Tshuva or something and you're Ashkenazi, you should wrap in. There's also another advantage to wrapping in, which is that in order to wrap outwards, there's this whole history. There's a new unpublished book that I have on this that's actually quite excellent, so I hope it will be published one day, about the whole history of the ksharim of the knots of tefillin. And it seems that the wrapping in knot is closer to the original way that the knot was tied in the times of the early Rishonim and Geonim. It's maybe not be exactly the same, but certainly unless you have a strong minhag to wrap out, you should get your tefillin in a fashion that you can wrap in. And the actual direction in which you wrap the ritzua doesn't make a difference. The whole question is the tzura of the knot. So teimanim actually have something that more closely resembles the Ashkenazi knot, closer to what was probably the original knot, but yet they wrap out because they switch the direction of the ritzua. They take, even though it's coming out this way, they switch it and go like that. So the actual direction doesn't matter. The real issue is the knot. So that's in terms of that. And the Kesher Shel Rosh is a little bit more of a highly charged issue. The Kesher Shel Rosh, the Gemara says, even more than the Kesher Shel Yad, is a halacha Moshe Misinai in terms of the exact way it has to appear. It was the conventional wisdom in the last 70 years or so, 50 years, that the single dalad, well, it's called the single dalad, although it's not really single versus double, is the correct one. And the square one is just easier to make, so people didn't bother making the whole dalad, single dalad, knot, and they went to the square one. There were even poskim who, Rav Soloveitchik, used to tell people that if they had the minhag to have the square, they should switch back to the dalad, which is very unlike him, because in most other issues, he used to tell people to adhere to their family minhagim carefully. It's unfortunately, though, that that's actually totally incorrect, that the Rishonim have many different sets of instructions. The Orchas Chaim has one. There's the Iter in the name of Rav Haigon. There's the Tikkun Tefillin. There's the Rias Kandrani, who was an early Acharon. They all give instructions of how to make the Kesher Shel Rosh. Very detailed instructions, very relatively easy to follow. And it all comes out the square. The Dalad Kesher, it seems, the research hasn't been fully complete yet. The Dalad Kesher seems to have started in the 18th century in Kabbalistic circles, and they spread like wildfire because, ooh, it looks more like a Dalad. The Kesher Shel Rosh is supposed to look like a Dalad. Probably what the real pshat is that the Ritzuas coming out of the Kesher, of the square Kesher, look like a Dalad. The Ritzuas and the Kesher are arranged in such a way so they come out of the back of the Kesher like this, like a Dalad. One points this way, one points that way. So certainly if you have as clear Masoret to do the Dalad, there is what to rely on. But if you don't have a Minag, you should do the square. And if you have the Minag to do the square, you should certainly not let anyone tell you to change, because that's probably the original, almost certainly the original knot. There's actually a story that Rav Yashiv used to be one of those people who would tell people to change. He would, when people come into him with shilas about tefillin, and he would see they had the square knot, he used to say, "Don't you know to make a kesher? It's supposed to look like a dalad." And he would tell them to change. So finally, someone who knew the truth wanted to change this, wanted to stop him from doing that. So he went into Rav Yashiv, this must have been years ago, to put on tefillin on his son for the first time. So Rav Yashiv took one look at the Shel Rosh and said, "Don't you know to make a kesher? Well, shouldn't I make a kesher?" So this person, who's a rabbi in Muncie, said, "Actually, you're right. I did not know how to make a kesher. But I looked in the Beis Yosef, and I followed the instructions there, and this is how it came out." So Rabbi Yosef was like, "What?" So he looked into it a little bit more, and he realized his mistake. And he didn't change, personally. He still had a dalad, but guess he was emotionally attached to it or something, but he agreed, and this is what he told his Talmidim to write in Zichron Elio, which is one of the major, which is the major work on the halachos of Batim and Ritzuas. He agreed with what they wrote there, that they wrote the truth there, that that the square kesher is the original. Okay, any questions on Ritzuas?
What's the minimum width for Ritzuas?
Oh, I had that written down, but I think... Oh, actually, that's actually for the maintaining share, but I'll go into it now. The minimum width is what's called Seora, which barley width, which is estimated at between 9 and 11 millimeters. So if your Ritzuas are about a centimeter wide, then you're okay.
Are the Sephardic tefillin and Ashkenazic tefillin the same? It's just that the people wrap them differently. That's basically the same, or they're different.
Well, the writing inside is a different style.
Also, there is some differences. Yeah. So, between the Sephardic and Ashkenaz. From the outside, it would look probably the same.
Also, you're going to have a shin on Sephardi tefillin. You're usually going to have a shin in Sephardi writing style on the outside of the bias also. That's not makiv. You can use a different style shin. It doesn't really matter what the shin looks like on the outside. You can use a different style on the outside than around the parshias on the inside. But normally, they go together. Normally, they go together.
Yeah. I got the term, but I saw there's two kinds of bites. There's one that's a thick and one that's a thin leather.
Yeah, the thin leather batim are called dakos, and the thick leather batim are called gasos. So this skin comes from actually the neck of an ox, which is the thickest skin in the kosher animal kingdom, apparently. At least usable skin.
Better than dakos, or is there a real difference?
Well, in terms of durability,
Don't break the table.
Oops. In terms of durability, I'll do it on this. In terms of durability, gasos are... Gasos are certainly better, but dakos had their advantages. They had bigger compartments in the middle, so you could fit nicer parshias, bigger writing parshias inside. But nowadays, dakos are really not made anymore. Mostly everyone has gasos. So I didn't even... It's not even a Shiloh. When you go to a dealer nowadays and you want to order tefillin, it's not even a Shiloh. They don't ask you if you want dakos or gasos. Oh, so okay. They could easily be dakos, yeah. They could be dakos could be very good. There's nothing. Just nowadays, the Jewish community is much wealthier than it was in Europe 100 years ago, so we can afford to shecht an occasional cow, or ox. Rabbeinu Tam Tfilin. There was a machlokas we showed him between Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam, among others. I mean, there are many, many people on either side of the issue, actually. Which is the order of the parshios and how they go in the shalrosh? And some people, I mean, maybe it's the shalyad. Also, some say it's only in the shalrosh. But anyway, the order, according to Rashi, is like this: Kadesh, Vayaki, Viacha, Shema, Vayayim, Shemoa. And Rabbeinu Tam reverses the order that he goes Vayayim, Shemoa, Shema. So that Shema and Kadesh are on the outside, and Vayaki, Viacha, and Vayam Shemoa are together in the middle. So that's called the Vehoyas are together. Vayaki Viacha and Vayam Shemoa. So it's called Havayos Ba'emza. It's called in the literature. So the Rosh actually started the practice. The Rosh, the Rosh's Rebbe, the Maram Rudenberg, who was the most nervous of, not the most maybe, but he was one of the more nervous Rishonim about Halacha. He didn't like being Machria. A lot of our Chumris that we have nowadays actually come from him, like taking a new fruit on Rosh Hashanah, I think, comes from him or his school, because there's a shaila about whether you can make Shechianu on second night of Rosh Hashanah or not. So he liked to be Yotzei al the Shita, so the Maram Rudenberg used to wear both Rashi, what's called Rashi Tefillin, which is also the Shita of the Rambam, and many others. And he used to wear both. So the Rosh recommended that anyone who's Yirei Shemayim should wear both Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam Tefillin. This is not the normal practice. Normal practice is like Rashi. We pass like Rashi. The Vilna Gaon said when Reb Chaim Volozhiner, his prime Talmud, asked him why he doesn't wear Rabbeinu Tam Tefillin also, The Gra said, well, there are many different machlokos, many different disagreements within the Rishonim about certain details about tefillin. So the Gra said to be Yotzei all of them, you'd have to wear 64 pairs of tefillin. By multiplying everything, let's say there's four way machlokas about this, then four times four. So the Gra basically just thought these were two shittas and you had to be machria, so he went like he paskin like Rashi, and that was it. Other people feel that since it was such a widespread shita in the Rishonim, to go like Rabbeinu Tam, they feel like there's more of an inyan to try to fulfill that shita than other shitas of Rishonim in terms of the certain pratim atvan.
And
the Dead Sea Scrolls, those types of things, there are different parshias than we have. They have different sections of the Torah written in them, different orders. They're not following...
But they definitely found Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam ordering.
They found all different orderings. There's different parshias. They found lots of stuff. But those still are not following accepted Pharisee rabbinic halacha. So it's not necessary to take those into consideration when deciding what to do. In any case, some people have the practice to, amongst Sfardim and Hasidim, it's much more common than amongst regular Ashkenazim. By regular Ashkenazim, it was usually reserved to the big Rabbanim Rashi Yeshiva, who used to do Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam. But by Sfardim and by Hasidim, basically the minhag is that every married man wears both Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam. Either at the same time, or more commonly, they wear Rashi during davening, then either at the end of davening or after davening, they switch into Rabbeinu Tam.
Is that a prevailing custom, or is it very few and far between? Because I've only seen a couple people in this community do that.
Well, this community would fall into the category of regular Ashkenazi communities for the most part, so it's not chock full of Hasidim or Sfardim, although I assume they're more Sfardim than Hasidim. But if there are any Sfardim, you can ask them. Any Sfardim here? Okay, so if you see a married Sephardi man, you can ask him if he wears Rabbeinu Tam also, or he comes from a community where people wear both Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam. Okay, that wraps up main things about purchasing tefillin. Any questions?
Question.
Sure.
Why doesn't some of the people wear Rabbi Tam tefillin first and then wear Rashi afterwards?
No, because Rashi is the ikar. We really paskin like Rashi.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, mezuzahs. In terms of purchasing mezuzahs, the main thing to keep in mind is within limits, get the biggest mezuzah you can. It's much harder to write small, and you're going to come out paying more money for a less quality mezuzah. I have here a few different sizes that you could. See the difference? Several different sizes. This is just for comparison. These are 10 centimeters. They come in centimeters because they're made in Israel. These are 10 centimeters. These are 12 centimeters. These are 15 centimeters. 15 and 20, I wrote myself. And this is, let me pass around that one. Oh, come on up. These are 20 centimeters. And they're even bigger ones than this. I once sold...
At Ben Gurion Airport, they have one.
Oh, yeah, huge ones, yeah. The biggest I've sold, not that I wrote myself, but the biggest I've sold is 25 centimeters, which I guess is like this. But that's really excessive. Really, you should look... The standard size nowadays is 15 centimeters, which is this size, which is probably bigger than most people grew up with and are used to, but certainly there's no... real reason to go smaller than this. Certainly not smaller than this. Don't do this. Unless you have an heirloom case in the family that you absolutely need to have a tiny mezuzah, it's really, really not worth it. Not at all. And you can get a tiny mezuzah that has gorgeous, beautiful ksav, but it's going to be so expensive because it's so painstaking. You know, a mezuzah... I once saw a mezuzah that was 7 centimeters, so even smaller than this. You know, like this. It was gorgeous, but it cost... It was probably $140 or something for that mezuzah, but it's unnecessary. If you wanted to get $140 mezuzah this big, it would be an even nicer ksav than in that mezuzah. So, just pass these around. So, oh, sorry, one on one side. Here's 20 centimeters. Here's 10. You can tell the difference just by looking at it. So the standard size should be 15 centimeters. Get 15 centimeters. And the main hakpados that I talked about last time are the same for tefillin and mezuzah in terms of getting a good dealer and in terms of a hakpados in the klaf and the writing, so I'm not going to repeat that, especially because we're short on time once again. If many, apartment dwellers is actually a much overlooked halacha, which is that if there's an apartment building which is mostly inhabited by Jews, then the front door of the apartment building actually needs a mezuzah, which I could discuss more in when we talk about placement of tefillin and mezuzahs. But the question is, what if you have Sephardim and Ashkenazim, to which you should get Sephardi ksav or Ashkenazi ksav? The answer is, probably doesn't matter, but you can go after the majority of residents. Yeah, right. Yeah. All right. Also, to make sure, for a mezuzah, there's certainly no disadvantage, as I talked about before, the issue of the parsha break, the machlokes between the Rambam and the Rosh, and the Taz's Eitzah to make a smaller space at the end of Shema, at the beginning of Ayim Shema, to try to be Yotzei both. But and for reasons I'm not going to discuss now, it's less problematic by mezuzah, so there's certainly no issue in doing a straight Rambam, having as much space as possible, really, between Shema and Vayam Shemoa in a mezuzah. That's what I do when I write my mezuzahs, unless someone specifically requests it otherwise. My standard is I try to leave as much space as possible between Shema and Vayam Shemoa, just to do like the Rambam. Because it's going to be kosher b'dieved, according to the Rosh also, which is not necessarily the case by Tefillin. Again, we'll talk about this more later, but to keep in mind whether the mezuzah requirement on a certain doorway is d'oraisa or d'rabbanan. If it's d'oraisa, some people want to have a nicer, to get an even nicer mezuzah. Well, if it's d'rabbanan, you don't have to be quite as makbid on the beauty of the ksav. Sifrei Torah. Anybody want to buy a Sifrei Torah here?
Sure.
Not this month.
Yeah. There's a mitzvah, technically speaking, on every Jew to write a Sefer Torah. Most people don't write them themselves. If they do anything at all, they commission a sofer to do it for them as a shliach. It's only Yotzi if you do that. Most people don't do it at all. But if you want to, certainly a good idea. If you have extra money floating around, buy a Sefer Torah. Yeah.
Couldn't you also fulfill that by writing one letter in a Sefer
Torah? Not really. It's an excellent question. It's a very it's an idea floating around, but really you have to write the Sefer Torah yourself. It's a shaila. If you own the Sefer Torah already and you fix a letter, maybe it could be like you did it yourself. But I didn't. We have to look into that more. It's really better than nothing, but really, really, you should write your own if at all possible.
If you write the last letter in the Sefer Torah, is it?
No, if it's someone else's Sefer, no, it's not really.
Same thing.
Yeah, same thing.
Where did that come from?
Do you have to write a Sefer Torah? It's drush on the. Yeah, one of the 613. It's a drush on the pasuk of Kisvu Lachem Es Hashira Hazos. That you have to write your own Sefer Torah.
The Rav
Melech has to write two, not just one. Everybody has to write one.
But he can tax you to get the money.
Yeah. So I admit that I have not yet started writing my own Sefer Torah, but hopefully one day. Why not? It's actually the materials are not so expensive. The materials, if you can write it yourself, the materials are only like $5,000. It's not. It's more. I mean, a new nice Sefer Torah costs $50,000 or something. Yeah, or more. I mean, anyway. So we're not going to spend so much time on Sefer Torah because most people, it's not Shaykh L'maisa. Megillos and Nevi'im.
We'll go back to mezuzahs and tools for one
question. Sure, yeah.
Checking mezuzahs.
Yeah.
How often should they be checked?
That's going to be the next, we're going to get to that next time, extensively.
Very good question.
So, in terms of Nevi'im, a lot of people, as I mentioned last time, a lot of shuls and yeshivas have the practice to read the Haftorah out of, or the Megillos of Koheles and Rus, etc., out of Klafim, out of, like, it looks like a Sefer Torah. So a lot of people talk about how, you know, the shul spend so much money on making sure they have nice furniture and this and that. Really, a better investment might be to get a Nevi'im on Klaf, or at least a Sefer on Klaf that has the at least the Haftorahs of every Parsha, which is much, much cheaper. It could even have the Nikudos and the Ta'amim in it, the Trub signs. It's called a Sifra de Aftarta, and that is preferable to reading out of a Chumash, a printed Chumash by far. So if Shul could afford that, that would be wonderful. There is a major raging machlokas in Israel about how to write Nevi'im and Megillos. Has anybody here heard of the Aleppo Codex?
Yes.
Okay, so the Gra was the first one to reinstitute writing all these things on klaf, and he didn't have the Aleppo Codex, so he did it according to the Tanakhs that were printed in his day. He made the Parsha breaks and the tzura of the songs in the Nevi'im and Ksuvim, like the printed Tanakhs of his day. Whereas, so people, some of the Kanoim, the zealots in Israel, have latched onto this, no, this is the Mesorah, we can't change. There is no Mesorah, he started it 300 years ago. So now that we have the Aleppo Codex, which was written by, not written, but put in with its vowels and trump signs are put in by Aaron Ben Osher, the famous Masoret, and he put, and who was really, that's what the Mesorah really is. So we should write, certainly if you order Nevi'im or Megillus or anything like that, so you should make sure that the Parshias and everything is written according to Ben Osher, Aaron Ben Osher, the Aleppo Codex, instead of the other Tikkun, which is called Berdichov.
Parts of that are missing.
We have copies of the parts, not word for word copies, but there were lists that people made. They looked before it was destroyed or lost or whatever of the Parsha breaks. They wrote everything down. We have basically everything.
And
the Aleppo Codex, Ben Usher, yeah, Ben Usher. This is a major issue in Israel. So,
what is the actually is the Aleppo Codex?
What is it? It's a Tanakh, a Tanakh that was written in the 9th century. The issue with that is that in Megillus Esther, the Aleppo Codex had, we don't actually have an extent, it had certain Parsha breaks that go against the real Mesorah that we have, certainly have, we know how to write Megillus Esther on Klaf. So there's a question as to whether you should write the Parsha breaks in the Megillus Esther now, according to the Aleppo Codex also. That's not a shaila I could settle easily. There were many differences of opinion amongst the Rishon about the Parsha breaks in Megillus Esther, so it's very reasonable to say that now that we have a very clear hachror, decision of where the Parsha breaks should be, by following Ben Usher, the Aleppo Codex, you should write even in Megillus Esther, but that's an even bigger issue than writing the Nevi'im scrolls and the other Megillus according to Ben Usher, which is certainly what should be done. In terms of buying a Megillah, there's no inyan per se to purchase your own Megillah, but it's a nice thing to have if you can have it in front of you and read along with the Baal Koreh. I mean, you shouldn't necessarily read every word along with the Baal Koreh, but if you miss a word, you could read it from an actual scroll, which is more lichatchila, more ideal than reading it from a printed book. There is something that's become a fad nowadays called a Hamelech Megillah, where every column starts with the word Hamelech. This has no basis whatsoever. It's a gimmick. It's if they want to charge you more money for it, say absolutely not. When I wrote my own Megillah, I made it specifically not a Hamelech Megillah.
I have one like that.
A Hamelech?
Yeah. I don't think he charged me one.
There's nothing wrong with it. It's fine, but it
looks cool.
There's no halachic source. There's no hitter. There's nothing mentioned anywhere. It's nothing. It's a gimmick. That's all it is. There's a machlokus between the Gra and the normal contemporary practice about how to write the names of the 10 sons of Haman. The normal practice is that they get a whole column all to themselves. But according to the Vilna Gaon, they actually just should be written as in a song type of fashion, in that same thing where it's one word on one end of the line and one word on the beginning of the line, one word on the end of the line. It could be written in the regular text. He says maybe it should be at the bottom of a column. But in any case, to solve this problem, to be able to be Yotzei both, they created something called an 11-line Megillah, where it has only 11 lines, which is the same number of lines that are in the names of the 10 sons of Haman, so it can be the same size as everything else and not take up its own column, and also can be Yotzei according to the normal minhag that it does get its own column. That is very strange that to make a sefer so small with 11 lines, there are people who are opposed to it on those grounds. But in any case, many quote unquote medaktikim have specifically an 11-line Megillah. Others who don't want to have an 11-line Megillah because it's very sticky. Either they have to choose either between the Gra or the contemporary minhag to blow up the Aseres Bnei Haman, so they take up their own column. The earliest Masoretic sources seem to indicate like they support the Gra, so that's one reason that maybe, even though the contemporary practice, the practice for many generations was to make it fill up its own column, maybe nowadays there's more of a reason to go according to just the Gra. But in any case, if you have a Megillah, even though the normal practice is to have them take up their own column, if you have a Megillah written by the Gra, not by the Gra, but according to the Shita of the Gra, that you're Yotzei from that Megillah, certainly. There's also an issue as to whether to attach an Eitz Chaim to the end of the Megillah, like in all the other Sfarim, like Nevi'im scrolls, and sort of like a Sefer Torah. The minhag in general was not to do that, but according to many, many Rishonim, you should put in an Eitz Chaim at the end of the Megillah.
Just one?
Just one, yeah. You should put an Eitz Chaim at the end of the Megillah, so many people nowadays try to accommodate that opinion, and they get a Megillah with an Eitz Chaim on the end. Okay, any questions? So I think we'll stop here, and next time we'll try to... Well, we have two more times, I guess, but we'll try to go through maintaining Stam and checking Stam, and maybe start placement. But we'll see what we have time for.